In the dead of night on March 10, 1980, Jean Harris drove 5 hours from the Madeira School in Virginia to Dr. Herman Tarnower's elegant home in Scarsdale. A headmistress in her mid-50s, she carried a .32-caliber pistol and a heart shattered by betrayal. Tarnower was a celebrated cardiologist, the author of the best-selling Scarsdale Diet. Their 14-year relationship had once pulsed with warmth and ambition. But recently, it had turned into a grim spiral of secrecy, infidelity, and harsh words. That stormy evening, Zhang confronted Hermann, and moments later, he lay dying, shot 4 times. She claimed the gun went off accidentally during a struggle. The city erupted in scandal. Did a devoted lover snap, or was she protecting a broken heart? Over the next 7 chapters, we peel back each layer, the affair's origins, the toxic ingredients of deception, and the courtroom drama that followed. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Jean Harris wasn't a woman prone to impulse. She was disciplined, articulate, and precise. The kind of woman who ran an elite girls' boarding school with an iron sense of duty and grace. Born in 1923 and raised in a quiet suburb of Ohio, Jean was every bit the product of upper-middle-class values. Educated, composed, and determined to rise above society's limitations. By the 1970s, she had become headmistress of the prestigious Madeira School in McLean, Virginia, shaping the lives of young women from America's most powerful families. Her personal life, however, was a different story. She had divorced young, raised 2 sons mostly on her own, and spent most of her adult life navigating the twin pressures of leadership and loneliness. That's when Dr. Herman Tarnower entered her world. And slowly, everything changed. Herman Tarnower was not the type of man you'd expect a disciplined woman like Jean to fall for. Brash, charismatic, and unapologetically self-made, he was a cardiologist with a booming private practice in Scarsdale, New York. He had served in World War II, built his name in medicine, and by the 1970s, he was living a bachelor's dream. Fine suits, like wildfire. By morning, the scandal had hit every major newspaper in the country. Scarsdale diet doctor slain by lover, read one headline. Headmistress accused of murder, said another. But behind the headlines, the real story of emotional dependency, mental health, and quiet unraveling was just beginning to be told. And in the courtroom, Jean Harris would soon face the fight of her life. It was late when Jean Harris turned her car onto Arbor Lane in Scarsdale. The neighborhood was quiet, the kind of place where porch lights glowed like soft lanterns and no one expected drama after dark. But on that night, March 10, 1980, a storm had already formed in the heart of one woman. She had driven 5 hours through the cold night air. Inside her purse, a .32-caliber revolver, 5 bullets in the chamber, 1 in the barrel. In her bag, a wrinkled nightgown, a toothbrush, a letter covered in red ink, returned to her from the man she was coming to see. The house stood still, elegant, brick-faced, and surrounded by sleeping trees. Dr. Herman Tarnower's porch light was on. From the driveway, she could see a faint light through the front room curtains. It was just after 11:30 p.m. Jean Harris stepped out of her car and walked up the steps like she had so many times before. But this time was different. This time she wasn't coming as a guest. She wasn't coming for a weekend visit or to enjoy a glass of wine by the fireplace. She was coming for answers, for justice in her own mind. And she was armed. She rang the bell. Herman opened the door wearing a robe, his gray hair slightly disheveled, glasses perched low on his nose. He looked surprised, not afraid, just puzzled. He hadn't expected her. Maybe he hadn't called her in days. Maybe he thought she was done trying. He let her in. They talked, at first quietly, perhaps awkwardly. The living room was warm and neat. A table lamp glowed in the corner, casting amber light over framed photos, newspaper clippings, and a bowl of prescription bottles. The air smelled faintly of cigar smoke and the sharp sterility of rubbing alcohol. Jean asked him about Lynn Triforos. She confronted him with the receipt she found, a gift for Lynn, the woman who had taken Jean's place. She showed him the letter he had sent back. Red pen markings, grammatical corrections. Not a single word about her feelings. Not a single apology. Tensions rose. Hermann brushed her off. He dismissed her concerns. He told her she was acting irrational. He reportedly said, "Jesus, John, you're crazy," a phrase that would echo through every courtroom retelling for the next year. Then came the final breaking point. Jean would later say she went upstairs briefly. Some reports claim she went to the bedroom and found evidence of Lynn's presence. Lingerie, a hairbrush, or a gift bag. When she came back down, she was more agitated. She took the gun from her purse. What happened next has never been agreed upon by everyone involved, but the facts, as pieced together from Jean's testimony, forensic evidence, and police interviews, go like this. Jean pointed the gun at Hermann. She claimed she wanted to scare him, to make him finally listen, to make him understand how deeply he had hurt her. Hermann, likely shocked, either lunged or turned. There was a struggle. A shot rang out. Then another, and another. 4 bullets in total struck his body. 1 hit his hand, perhaps as he tried to grab the weapon. Another struck his arm. 2 landed in his chest. Fatal shots. He stumbled, slumped, and fell back near the bedroom doorway. Blood pooled on the beige carpet. Jean froze. She later claimed the gun went off accidentally during the scuffle. That she didn't mean to shoot him. That she was disoriented, not thinking clearly, overwhelmed by fear and sorrow. The truth of her intent, whether it was premeditated or spontaneous, would become the focus of the trial that followed. But in that moment, there was no courtroom, no jury, no headlines, just silence. And one woman, staring at the man she had loved for 14 years, now lying on the floor, gasping for breath, blood soaking through his pajama top. Jean moved toward him. She said she tried to help him. She reached for a towel, tried to press it against his chest. She asked him to tell her what to do, but there was no answer. Minutes passed. She called her son, David. She told him something terrible had happened, that she had hurt someone, that she needed help. And then, finally, she called the police. When officers arrived at 17 Arbor Lane just before 1 a.m., they found John Harris waiting calmly in the front hall. She handed over the revolver without protest and said one line, quiet, composed, "I just shot my friend." Inside, Dr. Hermann Tarnower lay dead, the once glamorous heart doctor who had changed America's diet. Now, a crime scene victim. Blood stained the hallway. The pistol sat in a brown paper evidence bag. Upstairs, signs of a life in motion. Neatly made bed, travel toiletries, and a woman's overnight bag still zipped on the guest room floor. Jean was arrested on the spot and taken to the Scarsdale Police Department. There, under harsh fluorescent lights, she gave a statement. She repeated her story. That she didn't mean to kill him. That the gun went off. That it was an accident. A tragedy. Not murder. But the law would demand more than an explanation. It would demand evidence. And from the moment news broke, the press began circling like sharks. The next morning, the story hit front pages nationwide. Scarsdale diet doctor shot dead by longtime lover. Educator arrested in high-profile homicide. America was transfixed. A celebrated doctor. A respected headmistress. 4 gunshots in the night. And a love affair gone so far off course that one of them ended up in the morgue. The other in handcuffs. Within hours, the case became a media sensation. Camera crews swarmed the crime scene. Reporters dug into Jean's past, combed through Madeira yearbooks, called her colleagues for quotes. Some painted her as a woman scorned. Others saw a cold, calculating murderer. No one could agree on what had happened inside that house. But one thing was clear. The trial of Jean Harris was about to begin. and the whole world was watching. March 11, 1980, the day after Dr. Herman Tarnower was shot, the headlines hit like a thunderclap. The Scarsdale diet doctor, the man behind a nationwide weight loss craze, was dead. And the woman who pulled the trigger? Jean Harris, headmistress of the elite Madeira School for Girls. It was a story made for the tabloids. Love, betrayal, murder, with just the right balance of class and scandal to capture national attention. But inside the Westchester County Jail that morning, there was no spotlight, no drama. Just a 56-year-old woman sitting in a holding cell, staring blankly at the floor, her hands trembling. Jean had spent the night under constant observation, wrapped in a standard-issue blanket, too shaken to sleep. She'd been charged with second-degree murder. Bail was denied. Reporters flooded the courthouse when she made her first appearance. Photographers pushed against police barricades, shouting her name as she was led inside. Her eyes stayed low, her coat tightly buttoned, hands cuffed in front of her. She didn't speak. The judge ordered a psychiatric evaluation and scheduled a preliminary hearing. Outside, the world was beginning to take sides. Some called her a victim, a heartbroken woman who had been emotionally manipulated, strung along for years, and finally snapped. Others called her a killer, educated, well-spoken, and cold enough to pull the trigger four times. And Jean, she said almost nothing. Her attorney, Joel Orneau, began preparing a defense that would challenge everything the public thought it understood about women, relationships, and rage. He argued that the shooting was accidental. A sudden moment of panic during an emotional confrontation, not a calculated act of murder. But the prosecution painted a different picture. District Attorney Carl Vergari described Jean Harris as a jealous, spurned lover who had driven 300 miles with a loaded weapon, intent on revenge. He emphasized the number of bullets fired, the fact that Jean had packed a bag, and her refusal to seek medical help in those crucial first moments after the shooting. To them, it wasn't passion. It was premeditation. And the media ran with it. Magazines called it the trial of the year. Television hosts debated Jean's character, her dignity, her intelligence, her fragility. Nora Ephron, the famed journalist and screenwriter, called the case a tabloid dream in New York Magazine. The idea that a polished, educated woman could be driven to murder captivated readers across the country. It challenged cultural expectations of femininity and restraint. Jean wasn't poor. She wasn't desperate. She wasn't from the margins of society. She was a woman with power, influence, and education. And yet, she had done the unthinkable. Shot a man she once loved, not once, but four times. As her legal team assembled their defense, Jean remained mostly quiet. She gave interviews sparingly, choosing instead to write letters, reflections, drafts of her eventual memoir. She wanted the public to understand that she was not a monster, that she had been in love, that she had lost control. Yes, but not because she was evil, because she was devastated. The prosecution disagreed. They called it a classic case of obsession, and they pointed to one key piece of evidence, the gun. Jean had brought it with her. That was not in dispute. The state argued that no one brings a loaded revolver 300 miles just to have a conversation. No one walks into a former lover's home in the dead of night, weapon in hand, unless they're prepared to use it. The public was split. Letters poured into newspapers, some supporting Jean, some condemning her. Women's rights groups questioned whether she was being vilified for expressing anger men so often got away with. Others argued that her elite status was shielding her from the harshest consequences. But behind the media circus, a very real human toll was building. The Madeira School Board placed Jean on an indefinite leave. Parents, shocked by the news, demanded answers. Some students cried when they heard. Others were confused, even angry. How could the woman who taught them about discipline, self-respect, and leadership be facing murder charges? Meanwhile, Hermann Tarnauer's funeral was held in New York, attended by hundreds. Former patients, colleagues, celebrities, and dignitaries showed up to honor a man who had become a household name. His coffin was lowered as eulogies praised his contributions to medicine and public health. Jean was not mentioned. She remained behind bars, awaiting trial. Then came another twist. It was revealed that Jean had written numerous letters to Hermann in the months leading up to the shooting, dozens of them. Some were calm, others were filled with despair. A few hinted at suicidal thoughts. One letter, the most haunting, said, "I feel like a ghost when you're not around. I exist, but I don't live." The defense argued that these letters showed vulnerability, a woman spiraling under emotional neglect and chemical dependency. The prosecution countered that they revealed a dangerous obsession. Both sides prepared for a legal battle that would test the limits of sympathy and the power of evidence. And still, the cameras rolled. Every court hearing was packed. Courtroom sketches appeared in papers nationwide. June became an icon, not of strength or clarity, but of contradiction. She was both victim and aggressor, polished and unraveling, noble and broken. By the time the jury was selected, the country was riveted. Would she testify? Would the psychiatric report support her claims? Could a jury of strangers truly understand what had happened inside that house in Scarsdale? No one knew for sure. But one thing was clear. The trial of Jean Harris would not just be about a murder. It would be about love, control, mental health, and the high cost of silence. And as opening statements began in the packed courtroom in White Plains, New York, Jean Harris, in a pale blue dress and pearl earrings, stood to face the charge that could send her to prison for life. The people of the state of New York versus Jean Harris began in earnest in January 1981, nearly 10 months after the shooting of Dr. Hermann Tarnauer. It would become one of the longest and most controversial trials in Westchester County history. 14 weeks of testimony, 65 witnesses, and a nation hooked on every word. From the first day, the atmosphere in the courtroom was electric. Reporters filled every seat in the press gallery. Spectators lined the back rows, some waiting hours for a glimpse of the woman at the center of it all. Jean Harris, dressed simply and with restraint, soft sweaters, neat skirts, a quiet dignity, sat between her defense team, showing almost no emotion. She never cried. She never slouched. She sat, hands folded, listening. The prosecution, led by Assistant District Attorney George Bolin, opened with a simple argument. This was no accident. Jean Harris had driven through the night, carried a loaded gun, and pulled the trigger 4 times. This was murder. Premeditated, deliberate. They laid out their case with chilling clarity. Ballistics experts testified that the gun could not have discharged accidentally multiple times. Each shot required a deliberate pull of the trigger. Crime scene photos showed Tarnauer's position, the spread of blood, and the bullet holes in his chest and arm. The prosecution walked the jury through the layout of the house, the angles of entry, and Jean's own handwritten notes recovered from her bag. But more than the physical evidence, they focused on motive, the letters, the jealousy, the years of rejection, the final insult, the edited letter marked in red ink. They painted Jean as an intelligent, calculating woman who had simply had enough. Then came the defense. Joel Orneau, Jean's attorney, faced a near impossible task. Explain how a brilliant, respected woman could end up firing a gun 4 times and yet not be guilty of murder. He argued that Jean's mental state was impaired, that she was suffering from depression, anxiety, and a chemical dependency caused by years of overprescription, that the shooting was not a planned attack, but a tragic, spontaneous act of emotional collapse. And yet, in one of the trial's most debated decisions, the defense chose not to call any psychiatric experts to testify. The reason? Orneau feared that introducing mental health arguments would open Jean to a manslaughter conviction and undermine the claim that the shooting was completely accidental. It was a gamble, and one that may have sealed her fate. Still, Jean took the stand. Over several days, she told her story in calm, steady tones. She explained the history of their relationship, The good years, the unraveling, the other women. She admitted to bringing the gun, but insisted she had not planned to use it. She said it was for protection. She said she only wanted to talk. Then she described the night of March 10th. She told the jury how Herman had dismissed her, how their conversation turned heated, how he called her crazy, and how he reached for the gun. She said it went off, that she tried to help him, that she never meant for any of it to happen. Her testimony was deliberate, clear, and at times deeply human. But not everyone believed her. The prosecution attacked her story. They questioned how someone could accidentally fire a revolver four times. They pushed her on why she didn't immediately call for medical help. They suggested that she had shot Herman while he was lying down, perhaps even after he had fallen, out of rage, not fear. The jury listened carefully. Jean's calm demeanor, praised by some as poise, was interpreted by others as coldness. Her education, her vocabulary, even her posture became points of speculation. Was she composed or remorseless? Outside the courtroom, public opinion remained divided. Some saw a woman pushed past her limits, emotionally abused, medically manipulated, cast aside. Others saw a woman who couldn't let go, who had made a decision in the dead of night and executed it with deadly precision. The trial dragged on. There were moments of high drama, like when the jury was shown Herman's blood-stained robe, or when Jean's letters were read aloud. One, written just weeks before the shooting, read, "If you don't want me, why don't you just say it? Why do you make me beg for crumbs from a table I helped set?" The words hung in the air. By March 1981, both sides had rested. Closing arguments were intense. The prosecution repeated their claim, premeditation. They asked the jury not to be swayed by sympathy or elegance. This was murder, pure and simple. The defense urged the jury to look deeper, to consider the emotional devastation, the impact of years of psychological erosion, and the fog of dependency. This wasn't a killer, they said. This was a woman at her breaking point. The jury deliberated for 8 days. On March 20th, 1981, the verdict came in. Guilty, second-degree murder. Jean Harris stood silently as the decision was read. Her face barely moved. No tears, no outburst. Just a small nod, perhaps acceptance, perhaps resignation. The judge sentenced her to 15 years to life in prison. The courtroom emptied. Reporters ran for phones, headlines rolled out within the hour. Jean Harris found guilty. From headmistress to convict, the Scarsdale murder, verdict delivered. But even with the trial concluded, questions remained. Was it justice? Or just the neatest end to a messy, painful story? When the iron gates of Bedford Hills Correctional Facility closed behind Jean Harris in 1981, many believed the final chapter of her story had been written. She was 57 years old, a convicted murderer, and facing a sentence of 15 years to life. The public, still reeling from the media circus of the trial, moved on. The headlines faded. The world turned. But Jean's story was far from over. Inside prison, she did not retreat into bitterness or despair. Instead, she began a quiet transformation, one that would reshape her public image and redefine her legacy. She started by observing, listening, taking note of the women around her, most of them young, many of them poor, and nearly all with stories that mirrored the same cycle: poverty, abuse, addiction, abandonment. Jean, who had once run one of the most prestigious girls' schools in the country, now found herself in a different kind of classroom. And she went to work. She began teaching literacy and GED classes inside the prison. She created programs to help incarcerated mothers stay connected to their children. She helped women write letters, fill out forms, prepare for life outside. She advocated, persistently, fiercely, for prison reform, focusing especially on health care and education for female inmates. By the mid-1980s, Jean Harris had become something few could have predicted, a respected prison rights advocate. Quietly, steadily, She was changing lives from behind bars. She also wrote two memoirs, Stranger in Two Worlds and They Always Call Us Ladies, offered rare, unsentimental insight into life as a woman in prison. She didn't excuse her crime. She didn't plead for pity. She told the truth as she saw it. Raw, clear, painful. Outside the prison walls, a cultural reevaluation of Jean's case had begun. Feminist scholars, legal analysts, and mental health professionals began to examine the trial through a new lens, one that considered emotional abuse, power imbalance, and the effects of overprescribed medication. Questions resurfaced. Had the justice system taken her mental state seriously? Should the jury have heard psychiatric testimony? Would the verdict have been different had her addiction to amphetamines, prescribed by the man she killed, been properly understood? In 1992, after 11 years in prison, then-Governor Mario Cuomo granted Jean Harris clemency. She had suffered multiple heart attacks, and her health was declining. But more importantly, she had served her time not as a passive inmate, but as a force for change. Her release was met with both praise and criticism, some calling it justice, others calling it preferential treatment. She left Bedford Hills quietly, without ceremony. In the years that followed, Jean continued her advocacy work. She spoke about prison reform, women's health, and education. She lived simply, avoiding the spotlight, refusing to cash in on her notoriety. She never remarried, never gave another romantic interview. She lived, in many ways, as a woman finally freed, not just from prison, but from the long shadow of Herman Tarnower. Jean Harris died in December 2012 at the age of 89. She left behind a legacy filled with contradictions. Headmistress, convicted killer, educator, prison reformer. She was a woman who made a terrible mistake, and then spent the rest of her life trying to create something meaningful from it. Today, the Jean Harris case remains one of the most studied examples of emotional entrapment, gender dynamics, and the intersection of love and law. It asks hard questions. What does justice look like when both people are wounded? What happens when a strong woman loses herself in someone else's power? And can a person truly be redeemed in the eyes of a society that once called her a murderer? There are no easy answers. But what is clear, painfully, powerfully clear, is that Jean Harris was never just one thing. She was many things at once. And maybe that's what made her story so unforgettable. Flashy dinners and a revolving door of admirers. But he was more than a playboy. In 1978, he co-authored a book that would turn him into a national phenomenon, The Complete Scarsdale Medical Diet. It was a hit, topping bestseller lists, dominating talk shows, and making him a household name. He was now, quite literally, a celebrity doctor. Jean met Herman through mutual friends in 1966. At first, their connection was intellectual. Long conversations, shared values, late-night phone calls that stretched into the early hours. He was older, confident, and deeply attentive. For a woman like Jean, who spent most of her time around students and staff, Herman brought something intoxicating, excitement. He sent her flowers. He called often. He visited her in Virginia. And slowly, they slipped into a long-distance romance that would last over a decade. But from the beginning, there were warning signs. Jean wanted commitment. Herman didn't believe in it. He made it clear that he wasn't the marrying type. His philosophy, he once said, was, "Why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free?" That line, offhand and cutting, would later haunt Jean as the relationship began to fracture. Despite their emotional intimacy, Herman was never faithful. Over the years, Jean would discover, sometimes directly, sometimes through whispers, that there were always other women. Some were former patients, some were much younger, but all seemed to follow the same pattern. They came, they dazzled, and they vanished. Meanwhile, Jean remained. She tolerated it. At first, reluctantly, then with increasing desperation. She told herself that she understood him, that his freedom was just part of who he was. But deep down, it hurt. The more she tried to hold on, the more he slipped through her fingers. To cope, she leaned harder into her work. At Madeira, she was revered. Students admired her. Parents trusted her. She gave impassioned speeches about dignity, honesty, and the value of strong character. Yet behind closed doors, her life was full of anxiety and longing. Hermann would cancel plans, ignore her letters, or disappear for weeks. Then, just as suddenly, he'd call again, full of charm and excuses, and she'd be back. By the late 1970s, the cracks in their relationship had turned into open wounds. Hermann was now publicly involved with a woman nearly half Jean's age, his office assistant, Lynn Triforos. Lynn was bright, pretty, and accessible. More importantly, she didn't pressure him. She didn't demand commitment. She let him do as he pleased. And that made her dangerous. Jean, by contrast, was growing more and more emotionally dependent on Hermann, and on the pills he prescribed. That's right. Hermann Tarnauer wasn't just her lover. He was her doctor. Over the years, he had written her thousands of prescriptions for amphetamines and tranquilizers. Jean took them regularly. By 1979, she was taking up to 5 different medications a day, uppers to wake up, downers to sleep, and pills to soothe her racing heart in between. Her mind was beginning to crack under the pressure. Her mood swung wildly. She became paranoid, tearful, and withdrawn. She wrote long, pleading letters to Hermann. She begged him to stop seeing Lynn. She offered to quit her job, to move to New York, to be with him full time. He didn't budge. In fact, he grew more distant, answering her letters with brief notes or not at all. He told her that Lynn was just a friend, but the truth was obvious. He wasn't hiding the affair. He simply didn't care that Jean knew. Still, she couldn't let go. Their final months together were a cycle of humiliation and hope. She would call him crying. He would respond with coldness. She would threaten to end it. He would ignore her. Yet every time he called, even to say something cruel, she would melt. She was in love, hopelessly, with a man who had moved on. By early 1980, Jean's emotional state had reached a breaking point. Colleagues at Madeira noticed that she seemed distracted and fatigued. She was making errors, forgetting details, losing control of meetings. One staff member recalled that she sometimes looked lost in thought, like she was listening to something only she could hear. Inside, she was unraveling. Then came the day that sealed everything. March 9th, 1980. Jean received a letter from Hermann, or rather, a note, returning one of her own with cold annotations scrawled in the margins. He had criticized her grammar, dismissed her emotions, mocked her tone. That was the night she made a decision. She packed an overnight bag. She placed a loaded .32-caliber revolver in her purse, and she began the long drive from Virginia to New York, gripping the steering wheel through hours of darkness. She told herself she was going to talk, to plead, to find some closure. But as she crossed the state line into New York and neared the familiar streets of Scarsdale, something inside her hardened. The woman who had spent 14 years waiting for love had run out of patience. And inside that quiet house at 17 Arbor Lane, the story that would shock the nation was about to begin. Jean Harris was known for her poise, the careful way she spoke, the crisp way she dressed, the calm authority she brought to the halls of Madeira. But beneath the surface, her life was becoming unrecognizable. What had started as a loving relationship was now deeply entangled in something darker, a psychological dependency that blurred the lines between love, health, and control. At the center of it all was Dr. Hermann Tarnauer. He was more than Jean's lover. He was also her physician, and that dual role gave him a kind of influence most partners never wield. When Jean complained of sleeplessness, Hermann prescribed sleeping pills. When she felt anxious, he offered tranquilizers. When she was fatigued or depressed, he gave her stimulants, usually amphetamines, which he called pep pills. He handed out prescriptions easily, often with little discussion. For him, it was just part of the relationship. But for Jean, the pills became a lifeline. By the late 1970s, she was taking multiple medications each day. Her morning began with stimulants to shake off the exhaustion. Throughout the day, she would take more to stay alert and focused. Then, as evening came, she'd reach for tranquilizers or sedatives to calm her nerves. This pattern wasn't casual. It was routine. Dependence had set in, slowly, quietly, and deeply. In court documents later revealed during her trial, Jean was shown to have filled more than 1,000 prescriptions from Hermann over the course of their relationship. It wasn't just the volume that stunned prosecutors. It was the fact that these were written outside of formal appointments, often handed to her in person or mailed to her home. Jean trusted him. He was her doctor. And in her mind, everything he gave her must have been safe. But the truth was more complicated. These medications, especially the amphetamines, were known to cause a range of psychological side effects, paranoia, mood swings, insomnia, and even hallucinations in some cases. Over time, they could erode a person's ability to cope with stress or think clearly. For a woman under emotional strain, they didn't help. They magnified the pain. And Jean was in pain. Everywhere she turned, she saw signs that Hermann was slipping away. His visits became shorter, his phone calls less frequent. When he did speak to her, it was often dismissive, filled with corrections, critiques, or cold instructions. The warmth that once defined their conversations had turned clinical. Even his handwritten notes had changed. They were now more like patient charts than love letters. Then came Lynn Triforos. She was young, in her early 30s, and she worked as Hermann's assistant at his Scarsdale office. She was efficient, attractive, and always nearby. Unlike John, she didn't challenge Hermann or press for a commitment. She admired him. She flattered him. She let him lead. And Hermann was captivated. At first, Jean dismissed Lynn as just another passing interest. She believed, perhaps hoped, that Lynn would fade like the others had. But Lynn didn't fade. She stayed. Hermann began bringing her to events, taking her on trips, even buying her gifts that Jean recognized from her own past birthdays. The signals were unmistakable and devastating. Jean felt betrayed, not just as a partner, but as a woman who had given over a decade of her life to a man who now treated her like an afterthought. The emotional fallout was immediate. Jean grew erratic. She wrote long letters to Hermann, some filled with heartbreak, others with quiet fury. In one, she accused him of humiliating her. In another, she begged him to explain why he still kept her around. She accused Lynn of manipulating him, of exploiting his fame. But Hermann didn't respond with comfort or clarity. He doubled down on the separation. He told her, in so many words, that she was being dramatic, that she needed to get control of her emotions, that he didn't owe her anything. And then, almost cruelly, he continued prescribing her the very drugs that were distorting her mental health. The contradictions were glaring. He told her to get a grip while handing her the pills that kept her unbalanced. He dismissed her emotions while maintaining the power to regulate her mood with every prescription, and he denied responsibility, even as he held her physical and emotional well-being in his hands. By 1979, Jean's world was shrinking. Her work at Madeira began to suffer. Colleagues noticed that she was forgetful, more easily agitated, prone to emotional outbursts in private meetings. She struggled to focus. Her students, once her pride, now seemed like a blur. Some faculty members quietly wondered if she was exhausted, or perhaps even unwell. And behind closed doors, Jean was unraveling. She started keeping detailed journals, obsessively writing down her thoughts, her fears, her suspicions. She saved every letter from Hermann. She reread them, over and over. She memorized phrases, looking for hidden meanings. She even kept track of phone calls, noting how long they lasted and how he sounded. Her emotional fixation became all-consuming. And yet, she still believed there was hope. She told herself that if she could just talk to him, really talk, he would come back. He would see her pain. He would remember the years they had shared. She convinced herself that Lynn was a phase, that Herman still loved her, or at least that he owed her closure. But Herman wasn't listening. In fact, he was planning to distance himself even further. By early 1980, he had begun talking to friends about ending things permanently with Jean. He had grown tired of the emotional toll. He wanted peace. Lynn was easy. Jean was no longer convenient. And that meant the long relationship, 14 years of passion, pills, and promises, was quietly approaching its end. Jean, however, didn't know this, not fully. What she did know was that she felt discarded, used, and replaced. The man she trusted had betrayed her. The medications he prescribed now left her feeling numb. Her life had become unrecognizable. In her journal, she began writing about justice, about fairness, about how deeply she had given, and how little she had received in return. She also wrote about driving to Scarsdale. She wrote about how Herman wouldn't return her calls. How Lynn had answered the office line. How she found a gift receipt in her mailbox from Herman, addressed not to her, but to Lynn. That night, something broke inside her. She sat in her Virginia home, staring at the receipt, her hands trembling. She reached for her purse. Inside was a small revolver, a .32 caliber pistol. She had bought it years earlier for protection, rarely used it, almost forgot it existed. But now, holding it in her hand, she felt a sense of power she hadn't felt in years. The next day, she would pack a bag. She would write a note to a colleague. She would start her car, put the gun in her handbag, and begin the 5-hour drive toward Scarsdale. But in her mind, the drive had already begun, and every mile was paved with heartbreak, silence, and 1,000 pills. The winter of 1980 arrived in Virginia cold and colorless, but Jean Harris barely noticed. Her days blurred together. Each morning she stood in front of her students at Madeira School with the same composed expression, delivering announcements in her clipped, precise voice. But inside, something had shifted. Something was breaking. Friends and colleagues didn't know the full story. They saw only glimpses, a missed meeting, a forgotten name, a quiet stare that lingered too long. Jean was still functioning, still showing up, but her control was slipping. The headmistress who once commanded every room she entered now seemed haunted. She was losing weight. She looked pale, tired, distracted. Her once razor-sharp attention to detail was dulled. Some days she barely spoke. Other days she talked too much, rambling, looping back to old memories, sounding more like someone trying to convince herself of something than explain it to others. The truth was, she was unraveling. For months now, Joan had been spiraling through a mixture of emotional torment and chemical imbalance. Her dependency on the medications prescribed by Dr. Herman Tarnower had become central to her daily survival. But the very pills meant to soothe her, amphetamines for energy, tranquilizers for sleep, barbiturates for the pain, were slowly dismantling her clarity. The side effects had grown severe. She was having difficulty sleeping. Her appetite had faded. She grew paranoid and anxious. She wrote in her journal obsessively, sometimes pages at a time, documenting everything. Phone calls, letters, tone of voice, things unsaid. It was as if she was trying to organize her mind through sheer force. But nothing was working. The final straw came in the form of a letter. Or rather, a returned letter. Jean had written a long, emotional note to Herman. It was filled with desperation, not just romantic, but existential. She pleaded with him to explain why he had changed, why he had cut her off, why he no longer cared. She hoped, maybe naively, that he would see her hurt and feel something again. But when the letter came back, it wasn't with a response. It was edited. Herman had sent the letter back to Jean, marked up with red pen, like a school paper. He had corrected her grammar. He had crossed out sentences. In the margins, he wrote brief critiques. Unclear. Too emotional. Run on. No acknowledgement of the pain. No answer to her questions. Just corrections. Cold. Clinical. Dismissive. To Jean, it was more than insulting. It was humiliating. A final betrayal. That night, she sat alone in her small living room, holding the marked-up letter in her lap. She didn't cry. She didn't speak. She just stared. And then she began packing. She folded a few clothes into a small travel bag. She gathered her makeup, a hairbrush, a nightgown. She added a copy of the letter, still marked up in red, and placed it carefully inside. And then she retrieved the gun. It was a .32-caliber revolver. She had bought it years earlier for protection. She had never used it. But that night she took it out of the drawer, checked that it was loaded, and placed it in her handbag. Slowly, quietly. She didn't make a scene. She didn't leave a goodbye note, but she did leave a short message with a colleague at Madeira saying she'd be away for a few days. No explanation, no details. And then she got in her car and started driving. The road from McLean, Virginia to Scarsdale, New York is nearly 300 miles of winding highway. It was late. The drive would take her through midnight and into the cold early hours. She didn't turn on the radio. She didn't stop for food. The car cut through the darkness like a blade. Her mind, as later described in her own trial testimony, was focused on one thing: confrontation. She had told herself she was going to talk to Herman, to demand answers, to ask why Lynn Triforos had taken her place. She wanted to see his face when she showed him the letter. She wanted him to understand what he had done. To her dignity, to her health, to her sense of self-worth. But whether she planned to kill him, that question would become the center of her defense. It was around 11:30 p.m. on March 10th, 1980, when Jean Harris pulled into the driveway of 17 Arbor Lane, a quiet, tree-lined street in Scarsdale. Herman's house sat at the end of a slope, lights still on in the front room. He was home. She stepped out of the car, took a deep breath, and walked up the front steps. She had been here hundreds of times before, but this time felt different. The silence of the neighborhood pressed in. The wind carried no sound. She rang the bell. Herman answered, dressed in pajamas and a robe. He looked tired, surprised to see her, but not alarmed. He let her in. For the next few minutes, the two talked. At first, it was quiet, civil. She confronted him with the letter. She told him she couldn't go on like this. She brought up Lynn, the gifts, the silence, the betrayal. Herman grew irritated. According to Jean's later account, he told her she was being ridiculous. He said he had every right to see other women. He told her to leave. At one point, he reportedly shouted, "Jesus, Jean, you're crazy." That's when the argument escalated. Jean reached into her handbag. She pulled out the revolver. She claimed that she had only intended to scare him, to make him listen. But what happened next remains one of the most debated moments in true crime history. 4 shots were fired. 1 hit his hand. 1 grazed his arm. 2 entered his chest. Jean would later say that Herman lunged for the gun and that it went off during the struggle. She said she tried to help him after he fell. She said she never meant to kill him. But Herman Tarnauer, the famous cardiologist, was dead. He died shortly after midnight on March 11th, 1980. Jean didn't run. She didn't hide. She stayed in the house. She called the police. When they arrived, she opened the door, gun in hand, and said calmly, "I just shot my friend." She was arrested on the spot. The news spread,